What's your favorite location to shoot at?
My house.
In your house?
Yeah.
Like film set?
Yeah.
Stop all this nonsense and fight!
Since I got into this marriage, all I have done is fight.
Areseh Ugwu is the best-selling author of The Smart Money Woman, a book that sparked a movement and became a hit Netflix series. But beyond the headlines, Areseh has been building something much deeper, a new cultural language for financial power, ambition, and self-worth.
Why do you think women are more cautious when it comes to investing?
If you have a high return or whatever, it's like, yes, I'm such a good investor. The minutes they lose money, it's like, I was scammed. But no, it wasn't a scam. You took a risk. It did not pay off.
But in this episode, we step behind the polished surface. We talk about the chaos of building a TV series in Nigeria, what success actually costs, and whether the life she's built is the one she truly wanted.
What Nollywood has been able to accomplish in this period of time is incredible. In Nigeria, we're piecing it together, begging our friends for locations, as in, let me shoot in your house, let me borrow your car for this scene. You know, like, we have to be scrappy, yeah, like, to make it work. So to even create the kind of quality that we're even able to create right now with the limited resources that we have, please, if you see a Nigerian filmmaker, give them a hug.
This is not just a conversation about money. It's about identity, power, and the silent battles women fight on the way to becoming.
Out of all the streaming platforms, which one's your favorite?
Boy, I do not have a favorite. Whoever pays me is my favorite.
Which one do you watch the most?
At 21, what did you think your life was going to look like? Like, the life you're living today, did you imagine it at that age?
Definitely not. I think at 21, I probably thought that by now I'd be a top executive at a bank. Mm. And I'd be somebody's wife with like four babies. But my life looks a lot different than I thought that. Look, I've built this incredible career. I've become a filmmaker. I recently did this, or a few years ago, I did this interview on that for my university alumni magazine. And they asked me, oh, when you were at Aston Business School, did you think that you were going to be a filmmaker? And I thought, no. It was not even like writing, producing, directing, wasn't anything that I thought that I would ever delve into. But now I feel like it just makes so much sense when I think about all the things that I'm passionate about and how much I've loved film and series and, you know, all of that. And of course, I have my beautiful daughter, Zakora. The bond that we have is like so incredible. I am so grateful to God for it, because I know that kind of thing is not easy to have, you know, especially with a 13-year-old.
I love it. I love watching your bond. It's so beautiful. And actually, speaking about that, if you could sit with your younger self for 10 minutes, what is one truth you would tell her?
It all works out. Be relentless. Be relentless in the pursuit of your goals. Don't second guess yourself. You are more genius than you realize. And just, yes, be relentless in the pursuit of your goals, because you can actually do it.
I love it. I love it. So I want to shift gears into Smart Money Woman, right? I see it as a media empire, right? Because there's so many different elements of it. And I was privileged to see the beginnings of when you decided that you wanted to write the book.
Yes.
And from the book, it went into, you know, to a TV series, and it was on Netflix and it's on YouTube. But what is the toughest battle you've had to fight to get it to that stage, from you writing it to actually it being adapted to a TV show?
You know what is so interesting? Like, because so many dramatic things have happened, right? From book to deciding to go on a Pan-African book tour to having the crazy idea to turn it into a TV series. From Africa Magic to Netflix to YouTube. There's so many different stories like in there. I feel like I could make a movie about, you know, making the movie. But I think that the biggest battle, if I'm being incredibly honest, has been with myself. Mm. With just realizing, like, from the start, because I have this bad habit. I will have this huge vision and set this big goals for myself. And then I start, and then I start to second guess it. I'm like, actually, can I really do this? Like, are you insane? Like, do you actually really think that you can not go to film school and then turn your book into a TV series and then teach yourself how to write a script and then raise capital to turn this book into a TV series and then get it on different, like, you know, streaming platforms? If I think about, like, what it has become now, I feel like in the beginning I might have been a little bit more scared. But I have this bad habit where I set the big goal.
Yeah.
I start, you know, on the thing, and then I'm just like, whoa. I said, who do you actually think you are? So I feel like if I spent less time worrying about whether it is going to work out or whether it is not going to work out, I would get there, you know, quicker. Mm. But I'm thankful for the journey. Like, I've learned so much, like, who this process has turned me into or made me become has been incredible, because, you know, obstacles really test your strengths and you realize what you're capable of when you're able to overcome, like, big disappointments or big, you know, obstacles.
Yeah. And I'm curious, what is the biggest shock you have faced doing, like, actually trying to adapt something into TV series? Is there anything that you're like, oh, I had no idea this would even happen to me?
Oh, girl.
You're like, I could go on and on.
Okay, so obviously, we went from, with season one, I wasn't super confident about raising capital because I thought, I don't know what the business model is here. Like, I'm literally just experimenting. So let me figure out a business model that makes sense, right? So I went to banks and Unilever and MasterCard and all these different brands. And I said, listen, I want to turn my book into a TV series. Give me money and give me money for production. And in exchange, I will give you ads and product placements. Brilliant, right? Like, because obviously the book already had all these, like, it had this fanfare already and all of that. So I thought it would be like an easy sell, especially for a bank. Of course it wasn't. It took so long, but at least we were able to, like, produce season one, and it got the fantastic reception on African Magic and Netflix. We were like top 10 for like 13 weeks. It was incredible. So I got so excited and I was like, oh my God, season two. Guys, if they let me do this thing, like, this crazy, and it had this sort of reception, wait till you give me money, as in, and I go and do this thing bigger and better. So I went and I raised capital, produced it in three cities, Lagos, Cape Town, Johannesburg. I wanted like a Pan-African sort of feel to the whole project, because I just thought, you know, bigger, better, more money, all of that. Long story short, we finished producing all of this. We start trying to find distribution, which we thought was a no-brainer. Like, we thought it was, in the entire process, all the things that I was scared of. Production risk. What if we don't finish? What if we can't raise enough capital to do it? Like, all the things I was scared of, I got through. And the thing that was my biggest shock was that Netflix was like, eh. Basically, we went back and forth, and in the end, they just did not want it. And I was like, wow, now I'm sitting here with this very expensive production that I know has a huge, you know, Pan-African audience. And how am I going to sell it? Like, if, you know, this is happening. So I'm there in this sort of, like, you know, dilemma. And I'm not going to lie. That rejection almost broke me. Because this was 2 years of my life that I had spent, like, working on this. But I was like, you know what? Wear your big girl panties and realize, girl, that this is part of entrepreneurship. It's not personal. It's just another obstacle that you have to face. So I sat there and I thought, you know what? How do we remedy this? And YouTube is becoming such a big market for Africa now, especially when we're having to wait so long to be at the and at the mercy of like big streamers.
Yeah.
You know, the thing I like about it is how it democratizes, you know, access. So I produce my thing, I put it on my platform, and I can monetize it, you know,
directly.
Yeah. It's a tough, you know, nut to crack, but I feel like we're on it and we're really, really doing it. Of course, we launched on YouTube to almost like 10 million views. The channel went from like 10,000 subscribers to almost 100K. And we're still building. Like, I'm in the process of basically like figuring it out and like creating more things like in the pipeline that we can use to build, you know, the channel, because, you know, sometimes it feels like something is an obstacle, but it might become like another opportunity. I started basically looking into like this whole like idea of film and YouTube, and I see incredible, you know, opportunities like in that market. Not to say that I'm never going to produce for a streamer again, because the idea is this is just one thing, you know, that you produced and didn't, it just didn't work out how you thought it was going to work out. But I feel like there's still a huge opportunity for the Smart Money Woman brand. The reception to season two was so overwhelming that I was crying for weeks because I was like, oh my God, I can't believe people love it so much and are so obsessed like with the characters. And it's always just such a blessing to have created something that people are that invested in. So yeah, like I'm so excited. Like we recently launched, because again, when you have to deal with disappointments, you're forced, if you're a real entrepreneur, you're forced to figure out how to solve the problem. How are you going to pivot to the next thing, like without like losing your confidence, right? So we got this incredible opportunity with Samsung to produce a spin-off of the Smart Money Woman. Actually, they just wanted a film. They wanted me to produce something on their phone. So they launched the Samsung S25, and they were like, this phone has incredible capabilities, AI this, it's great for filmmakers. And I was like, okay, this could be interesting. So I spent all Christmas writing like a spin-off of Smart Money Woman called Lara Unlimited that focuses on one character, using a Samsung, you know, S25. It looks amazing. We're in post-production now. Can't wait for it to come out. And we just finished producing another film. And I'm excited for my filmmaking career.
No, I gotta say congratulations. I feel like I've always admired your work. I got introduced to your work before.
Ethic is epic.
Thank you.
Of course. But I also got introduced to your work before I got introduced to you, right? Mm. So it's good that having met, I'm like, yo, RSA does her thing. But I think some of the questions I had was, one, before I even go to my main question, some people might say, you know, you produced Smart Money Woman season one and then you got a Netflix deal.
Yeah.
Usually it's the other way around where people go to YouTube first, gain leverage, then get Netflix. So I don't know, what do you think about the whole process of utilizing the YouTube channel to gain leverage, even in conversations? Because now they're like, look, Issa Rae, I believe, built a YouTube channel first before she then went to HBO, right? Mm. So do you see that as also leverage play where it's like, look, guys, either you take it or I already have distribution through my YouTube channel. Yeah. And then that way your leverage is built in these conversations as well.
You know what I think is giving me? I think it's giving me future protection. Mm. So it's given us the opportunity, because Smart Money Woman is such a special project that has a very special IP that comes with its own inbuilt audience. And I feel like that makes it the most amazing thing to put on a platform like YouTube, because then you own the audience, right? And looking at the comment section, oh my God, it's a party, like in the comment section. And I feel like if we build that channel and grow that audience, there's so many opportunities for merchandising. There's so many opportunities for product placements. Replicating the kind of thing that we're doing with Samsung. I just feel like you then now have the option to say, listen, because now I've decided this is my career path. I want to build a pipeline of films that have an incredible social impact. And I want to do that, you know, I want to do that kind of storytelling through film, right? It means I can sell it to Netflix, I can sell it to Amazon, but if I have my own channel, I can take it directly to my audience. And this pivot gave us the opportunity to basically like build that fan base and make that channel something that's viable. So people might not see like the benefits in the short term, but I think that in the medium to long term, like they definitely will.
It's leverage.
Yeah.
I woke up this morning and I shared a tweet with Chika, and me and her have this conversation all the time around women not necessarily always feeling too comfortable talking about money, even in friendship groups. Whereas as men, we're all in our group chats, sharing deals, making investments together, just getting good deal flow and being open about it. So I wanted to get your thoughts on the tweet itself. It says, my boyfriend says him and all his friends talk about money all the time. How much they make, how much they bought houses for, screenshots of checking accounts, what they paid for engagement rings, etc. He's blown away that my female friends or colleagues don't. I said it feels incredibly rude and improper. He said this is why women get paid less and get screwed in any form of commerce more than men. What do you think about that?
Oh my God, my second book is basically, The Small Money Tribe is basically about that. It's basically around the premise that when I'm in a room with men, I realized there are more business conversations, investment opportunities, like being discussed, right? But when I'm in a group of women, that is less likely. So I started noticing that with women, even if they would talk about business, they would talk about more how to balance being a wife and a, you know, and a mother and a businesswoman, like more of the soft things, not necessarily about what did I do to reduce costs to that impacted my bottom line? What am I doing to aggressively improve my revenue like this, you know, quarter? Because, and I really feel like it's important to have those conversations, especially with your inner circle, because we learn so much from, again, storytelling, learning from each other's like experiences. So I don't think it's necessarily everybody doesn't have to know your business, right? Like you don't have to be like, oh yeah, this is my revenue, this is my profit, this is how much I earn. But I feel like in certain, you define what your circles are, your inner sanctum of people that, you know, you trust, you know, with that information. I feel like it's important to have that vulnerability where you can say, guy, I need to increase my, you know, revenue. Let's like share ideas about, you know, how to do that, or how did you do that in your business, or when you had this tax problem, how did you solve it, or when your staff, you found your staff stealing and whatever, what was the, you know, what were the legal steps that you took to, you know, remedy this? We get there faster when we learn from other people's experiences or mistakes, you know, or whatever you call it.
Why do you think women are more cautious when it comes to investing? I know I can speak for Chika. Like even some of also Chika's friends, when we had discussions, is when we're in these group chats, we're moving in size. Like if we feel something that we're really convicted about, we're like, look, let's make this investment as a group. And this is mostly men. And she was saying it's much more harder to have those same of conversations with women, because women are a little bit more cautious of losing the money. Because when we invest, we know 100% that this money that we're investing can go. Make peace with it at the start. And sometimes you take the L's, right? But sometimes you also reap the benefits. Why would you say women are a little bit more cautious?
So this is why I'm even, what I was even talking about in terms of why it's important for us to have those kind of conversations. Because I think that we don't, especially in our friendship circles, we don't leverage enough on our strengths and weaknesses. Like I feel like it's important for us to be plugging, using our strengths to plug other people's, you know, weaknesses in our friendship circles, right? So imagine if there was somebody in the if you talked about money all the time, and there was someone in the friendship circle that was a risk taker, and you've seen them take risks and that have paid off or whatever. I feel like it rubs off. Like the more you have that conversation, conversation, the more confident you become about, you know, having it. And I think that, yeah, women are scared of losing money, but I don't think it's just women. I think Nigerians in general are very risk averse, but want high returns for their risk averseness. Like, and, you know, it just doesn't work, you know, that way.
Socialist capitalists.
Yeah. So it's very much, you know, if you have a high return or whatever, it's like, yes, I'm such a good investor. Da, da, da. The minute they lose money, it's gone. Like, I was scammed. It was a scam. I was not, but no, it wasn't a scam. You took a risk. It did not pay off. Like, and I wish that I could say that it was only women that this happened to, but it's a lot.
Yeah.
A lot of men that this happens to. Like, you hear, I'm sure you know, yeah, what I'm course, talking about. Like, it's like, guy, no. You took a bet. It did not pay off. That is exactly what risk is.
Yes.
Yeah.
But actually, I have another layer to this question around friendships, because so personally for me, right, I love having these conversations with my friends around business strategy, how we're making money, like very tactical things, because I am like, anything I have, I want my friend to have, and I'm hoping the same thing. But I also have found some women see you as transactional, right? And a lot of times I've seen this on threads where, and I funny enough, we have this conversation all the time where Echo will be like, why don't you ask your friend for this business thing? And I'm like, yeah, but if I do, it comes off like I'm being transactional. Like, a lot of times women want, oh, how are you? How's your children? How? Like, they want this warm cuddle thing before we get to the
I think the answer to that question is discernment. I don't think that you can have that kind of relationship with everyone. It's not realistic to think there's certain people that, you know, you're not going to go and ask, oh, how much you earn, or how much, like, it would just be inappropriate.
Yeah.
But I think that you need to cultivate, like, those circles, whether it's, like, in your work circles, so that you can ask, you cultivate a relationship where it's, like, we can be vulnerable enough with each other to say, how much are they paying you? And know that, like, you know, we have each other's backs if, you know, there's some kind of, like, discrepancy with, you know, payments or whatever. But even, like, your close friend circle of friends, it's not everyone that is in your circle of friends that is going to be comfortable with talking about money. But I think we know, like, I think you have to pray for a spirit of discernment, because you know the kind, you know instinctively the kind of people that you can develop those relationships with, and you know the kind, because think about it, like, I'm sure there are people who think that they have a certain relationship with you that would come up to you with something and you're like,
correct huh? Like, well, where is this coming from?
Like, I don't even want to know this information, like but so I think it's about discernment.
And speaking around money and how you've been helping and teaching women with it, has there been a money mistake you've made that you didn't even see coming?
You're girl, like, I make money mistakes all day, every day. I make money mistakes all day, every day. I think that people mistake you writing about money and writing about personal finance for perfection. And I think that that is ridiculous. I'm a great writer. I do know a lot about personal finance. I think about these things in a very different way. And I know how to break down the financial jargon in a way that everyone can understand. And that is the superpower in the whole, like, Smart Money brand. It's not like, oh my God, I'm so perfect for my money. I don't make mistakes. I don't lose money. No, but I think I'm more resilient than most. My favorite thing about, like, my money personality is I can always bounce back. Like, I don't die from mistakes. Like, if I make an investment, it doesn't make money, I might cry for a few days, I might be upset, I might be irritated, but I will figure out a way, like, to move on from it. And I'm a big risk taker. So, and I think that being a big risk taker means that sometimes you lose big, like, and you have to be willing to deal with that. You need to be resilient enough to deal with that. Because I hear people saying, oh, I'm a risk taker, but then your blood pressure is high when one small thing does not go accordingly. Yeah. Do you get what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, so I make mistakes every day, but I I'm grateful to learn from my mistakes, to build, you know, on my knowledge and, you know, just transact every day.
Was there a mentor or somebody who guided you in your understanding of money, investments, how to even take risks? Who have you looked up to? Who are some of the people you've looked up to?
I think I draw inspiration from everyone. Mm-hmm. Like even think about it, like even for storytelling, there's some of the things that I write about that I have not experienced. Like there's certain perspectives, whether it's, I learn from my domestic stuff. Mm. My housekeeper, Sarah, has a small business running in our house, in our compound, where she's selling things like bread and Pepsi provisions. And eggs and provisions to all the other like domestic stuff and people that like are in, you know, the compound. And I feel like that is genius. The nanny I had before for years learned how to braid wigs.
Yeah, I remember. Like,
and she was doing that as a side hustle while she was, you know, in my house. And I'm inspired by, you know, women like that, that are like, listen, how am I going to multiply my income? As in my salary is not enough at every level. And then I'm inspired by, you know, women like Tara Fela Durotoye, Ibukun Awosika, Osayi Alele. I learned so many different things from each of them. Bolale Austin Peters, like just watching their journeys or experiencing parts of their journeys with them has only inspired me to try to do more or to aspire to, you know, to do more.
Yeah, and I'm curious, you know, we talk a lot about women being financially independent. That's a huge conversation. But I feel like lately the conversation has shifted to how do you balance that with love, with relationships, with friendships? Like, do you think there is a balance or do you feel like women have to make a decision?
I think that money, whether we like it or not, is a very integral part of all our relationships or all our experiences throughout the day, from your choice of what to eat to where you and your friends decide to go and have, you know, lunch. You know, like it affects every, you know, decision that you sort of like make. So I think it's something that's intertwined in our lives. So the decision making is really about choices, like within your lifestyle to support whatever it is like your money values are. Like, so for example, if you're in a friendship circle where people are pressuring you to do things that your income cannot support, maybe that's something that you need to be, you know, looking at, right? Like, or what is the financial dynamic between you and your partner? So I don't know that it's that women have to make a choice about, oh, am I going to be financially independent or do I have friends or do I have, you know, love at the expense of like my financial independence. I don't think it's like an either or thing. I think it's a very much, we develop values that determine what our choices are, like throughout our everyday like experiences with life or whatever. And the choices determine, you know, what the outcomes are. So I think for me, it's about just learning how to navigate what feels good, not being in, you know, toxic situations, either with partners or friends, you know, especially when it comes to like your income.
Yeah. And actually, speaking of that, I'm like, right now the economy is hard, mm-hmm. right? let's just have a moment of silence for the economy, right? And I'm curious, do you feel like, personally, when I moved back, right, I felt like there was a lot of keeping up with the Joneses, right? Like, I remember it was my first time entering a room, and I literally see, it felt like everyone had Chanel bag. Whether it was real or not was another conversation. And I felt this kind of like, oh, there's rage rules. There's like this element of I have to keep up, I have to look good. Do you feel like that's kind of died down a bit? Or are we still giving that energy?
So, I don't know. It's always been a tough one for me, because the thing is, if I see someone like carrying a Chanel bag or traveling business class, I don't automatically think that they're trying to make me feel a type of way. Like, I just feel like that is their life, right? Where I think that there's a problem is where individuals, and all of us are the ones that know what is going on, like in our heads or like when we have to go to bed at night, if you're allowing other people to pressure you, right? Because sometimes we forget that like the thoughts that we have are a reflection of what's going on
in our own,
do you get what I mean? Like in our own mental state. Because yes, sometimes there are people who are definitely keeping up with the Joneses, where they're trying to, you know, borrow to buy things so that they can keep up with a certain social circle. But I think that the reality is there are people who can afford these things, who can afford these lives. And so it's always very complicated for me to answer this sort of question, because it's such a complex thing. I feel, and the way I feel about it is complex. I feel like people should not be keeping up with the Joneses, but I feel like people also need to come to terms with the fact that there are people who are living this life. This is just their life. They're not trying to tension you. This is just their life, right? Like, so it's not about you, and you need to work on your feelings of making their lifestyle about you. For me, the biggest thing that I hope that Smart Money Woman did for women is self-confidence, like to the power to know who you really are, like regardless of what you own materially or do you get what I mean? Yeah. Like I think that is the most important thing, like the self-awareness to be able to say, okay, it's okay that this person has this and I don't. That does not make them any better than me or any, you know, worse. And I think it's an important thing to instill in our girls. Although otherwise, like, you grow up constantly pushing the boundaries of what you think, you know, you should have. So there's nothing wrong with liking nice things.
Yeah.
It's just, don't get into a cycle of putting yourself under pressure because of what other people are doing.
Yeah.
And one of my favorite quotes is, play long-term games with long-term people.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like one of the things I appreciated with watching season one was it felt like you'd, in a world where a lot of women compete against each other, it feels like you really have really good relationships with people, and that has compounded over time. How have you been able to navigate those relationships, and what advice do you have for even other women who are looking to come through that path to be able to leverage relationships that they have, but not also feel like, you know, it's...
they're transactional.
Exactly. What is that nuance there?
I think the big thing for me is I'm incredibly lucky because, first of all, my foundational friends I've known since I was 10. I'm going to be 40 next month. Like, that is a really long time to have learned people. I've gone from high school to university to heartbreak to marriage, divorce, childbirth, child loss. There's so much that you learn about maintaining a relationship, for being friends for that long and navigating, you know, so much together. But I think that because I had that foundation, it gave me like the opportunity to basically like be one of my favorite things is meeting new people. So because it's like I'm not looking for friends, I have my foundational friends, so I have the freedom to go and like get to know other people. And then if it works out, it's great. If it does not work out, I have my friends. I still have my friends. So I feel like that feels like a privilege. But with regards to like not making relationships transactional, when I meet new people, it's always about me being authentic. I know everyone says this, but I mean really being authentic about even yourself and accepting the fact that you can't be friends with everyone. You're not going to, your energy and everybody's energy is not going to mesh. Vibe. Do you get what I mean? But the people that I do meet and it's like, wow, we're gang. Like, immediately honor that energy. If it doesn't come, you know, naturally, I let it go. Because again, I'm not desperate for relationships. I have so many like amazing like friendships. And I think that not coming from that place of, oh my God, I have to be friends, you know, with this person and trying to force it is very, very important.
And I'm just curious because I really enjoy watching your friendship with women that you've known for such a long time.
Yeah.
You've gone through many decades, many transitions. has there been a moment of feeling comparison with them? Mm-hmm. And I say that because I know with me and my best friend, right? Mm-hmm. She married like 7 years before me, mm-hmm. had children, two children, right? So we kind of had a moment of like different walks of life. And luckily we've been able to maintain the friendship. But I'm curious, with all these different women, different stages, has there any been challenges troubling through those different decades of life?
I think because we're just not made that way. Mm. And maybe because we've been friends for so long and our friendship is thankfully not about material things. It's about shared values and shared history. And it's about really enjoying each other's company. So, and we genuinely love each other. And I would say that my friends are like my biggest cheerleaders and my biggest like people that are there to mourn with me when something bad happens. Like, they will pull up. Like, so we don't get into the habit of like comparing like each other to each other. Like, it's just like, this is your life's journey. Yeah. This is my life's journey. And we're just grateful to be able to like share experiences. But thankfully we're all doing amazing. Like, we're all doing so well. And when I look at like how far we've come and like who we were when we were little, compared to like now, it's just like the most incredible thing ever. Mm. So,
and speaking of friendships, what is one unpopular truth that you think nobody talks about when it talks about female friendships?
Unpopular thing.
Yeah, it's like unpopular truth.
I think the one I just said, not everybody can be your friend. I feel like there's I feel like there's this thing about, especially in Nigeria, where there's an expectation of everybody has to like you for you to be considered a likable person. But I feel like the people you vibe with, you vibe with. The people you don't vibe with, I just don't think it's a good idea to force it. Like, because sometimes it's just our values are not aligned. Sometimes it's just...
We just don't vibe.
Like, so why are we forcing it? Do you know what I mean? Like, and I think it's okay to accept that, yes, like, female empowerment is great, but the idea that you're going to be gang with every single female that you meet is crazy to me. Mm. So, yeah, that is my own unpopular opinion.
I would say one thing I know I've been curious about, because you're basically an insider, and it's good to get insider perspective. Mm. Now you're here with us. Mm. It's the current situation of, like, the streaming situation in Nigeria, right? Mm. Whether it's with Netflix or Amazon. I think they said Amazon might have pulled out. Mm. But I think the larger question I wanted to ask is your perspective on, I don't know if you saw that John Boyega clip where he explained the differences between Hollywood and trying to break into Nollywood, and saying sometimes it's not as professional over here in Nigeria compared to like maybe in South Africa. Mm. And that's why a lot of Hollywood studios tend to want to go to South Africa to even make movies about Nigeria, right? And I guess I wanted to get your own perspective, having worked in the industry, what are some of the challenges that you're seeing along with the streaming platforms and just professionalism in the space?
So it's so interesting because I was actually there when he said this. So I was in the room when he said this. Okay. And one of the things that I had to say in response was, yes, like we do have less professional, you know, productions here, mainly because this industry has had to create itself, mainly because this industry has had to create its own funding. Like, what Nollywood has been able to accomplish in this period of time is incredible, with very limited government support, very limited private
sector funding,
like, that's accessible to filmmakers. It is insane that they basically dragged this thing on their backs and got to the point where they can be selling stuff to streamers. So it's easy to say, compare Hollywood to Nollywood, but the budgets are not the same. The payouts are not the same, right? Like, what a movie that, you know, it comes out of Hollywood, even if it's a low budget movie, is given as a budget, is in millions of dollars, right? In Nigeria, we're piecing it together, begging our friends for locations, as in, let me shoot in your house, let me borrow your car for this scene. You know, like, we have to be scrappy, like, to make it work. So to even create the kind of quality that we're even able to create right now with the limited resources that we have, please, if you see a Nigerian filmmaker, give them a hug. Give them a hug. It is tough out here. It's not like tech that has, you know, people think about capital in a very generalistic way, but a lot of the capital that is being raised in private equity or VCs is very tech focused. It's only now that we're starting to hear rumblings about, oh, people want to invest in the creative sector. We're interested in creatives. But it's not as accessible yet, but we're hoping that it's going to get there. But make no mistake, what Nollywood has been able to accomplish, like in the last several years, on their backs, must be respected.
No doubt. I think the other thing I would want you to speak to is for people who don't know about the space, or like let's say there's a VC or an investor who's thinking through maybe investing in the creative space, what are the monetization possibilities? Like if somebody invests in a film, what sort of returns can they potentially get? Or just in general, what are the monetization opportunities?
So basically streaming, incomes from streaming platforms in terms of like licensing fees, product placement, like working with brands and getting them to pay to get brand mentions and product placements on the project. If it's YouTube, is ad revenue, like if you've done your marketing properly and you have like the views. So they're different. I feel like they're different dimensions, but it's definitely a long-term game.
I think one question I wanted to ask is, as you were filming, has there ever been a moment you're like, this is not even worth it? Like, I don't know what's going on, but today is
like... Do you know, it's so funny, right? Like I saw a clip of Timini saying in an interview that filmmakers, like, you have to be crazy to be a filmmaker, that everybody that does this is a weary. And I have to agree, because you have to have a certain sort of madness. Like, even when I look at my crew, right, and what they're paid to do what they do, it is insane. The late nights, the early mornings, but even when we're tired, the attention to detail is still like, guy, that light is not doing what it's supposed to do. But guys, 11:30 at night, do you get what I mean? As in, but people stay at it, like they keep at it, because we're all excited to be on set and be part of creating this thing or bringing this story to life. So the energy is different, right? So I think we definitely have days where it's just like, what is you doing, baby? Like, it's 2 a.m. and we have to be up again in the morning as in to get this thing done. And why am I doing this? But I think it always just feels great in the end when you've actually brought something to life, like literally drawn an idea from your head, gone through the trenches, fought all the battles, and then it basically, you know, becomes something tangible that like other people are experiencing and they love. I think that there's not only value in that, there's joy in that. So it's what keeps us sort of like going, even on the worst days.
Awesome. So during our rapid fire sessions, we ask you rapid fire questions. So the first one is, what's the worst financial advice you've ever heard?
I think it was what was that? Ponzi scheme that
MMM.
Yeah, it was when I witnessed somebody like actually like convincing another person about this like so vehemently, and I was like, I'm so confused about why you actually think that this is such a strong, as in, hill that you want to die on, and this thing is bullshit.
It's a scam.
It is a scam. So yeah.
What's the last thing you splurged on that made you feel guilty in this economy?
He said this. You have to add that part.
It's always food. It's always my desire for food at slow.
Why does it make you feel guilty though?
Because I just feel like the way we've gone from the two things I hate paying for right now, petrol in my car.
Let's not go there.
And restaurants, like what you used to spend like on restaurants has quadrupled. Yeah. Like, so it can't be as regular as it used to be, because it's just like, bruv, how do we, I just breathed at the menu and the bill is what?
No. You know what's crazy? I saw my one of my bake savers, and yeah. I said, this gotta stop. this food is getting expensive.
I really like eating out. Like, that is one of my guilty pleasures. Yeah. For the longest time, like, I would find ways around it, like partner with restaurants to do things, because this is just part of my lifestyle. I really like eating out, but I hate paying like the amounts that I would have paid if I was taking 10 people out, like on one, you know, experience. Like, is
things have changed, man.
Things have changed. So yeah, it does feel
steep.
People are not even putting prices on their menus anymore.
Yeah, that's true. Wait, do you actually have a favorite restaurant?
Like, to be honest, Slow and RSVP in Lagos are my favorite, because consistency. Like, I love the consistency of the experience. I love the consistency of the food. Yeah.
You put me onto that kale salad.
Yeah. Oh my God, that kale salad. That's one of the things that I feel guilty about now. Like, as in every time I think, like, it feels somehow sending my driver to buy it. I feel like he's judging me.
Okay. Out of all the streaming platforms, which one's your favorite?
I do not have a favorite. Whoever pays me is my favorite.
Which one do you watch the most?
Again, I don't have a favorite. I'm not even trying to be funny. Yeah. I have such weird tastes, like, and such diverse tastes that I watch so many different things on so many different platforms for so many different reasons.
If you could fix one thing about Nigeria's financial system, what would it be?
Why is it so hard for us to send money to other African countries? Like, the logistics of cross-border trade is something that somebody needs to figure out, because it makes no damn sense.
Who would you say is your favorite director to work with?
Myself. Because I have recently directed two projects.
Okay.
And I had a really good time doing it, because I brought my cinematographer, Majid, from South Africa. And it was like such an amazing experience, basically bringing, because I think when you write, not that it's easier to direct, but it's like you see the vision. I've been very, very excited about, I wrote it so I can see the vision in my head, and I'm able to direct what that vision is without having to explain it to someone else. So being a part of, you know, that process in that way has been very special to me. So yeah, right now I'm my own favorite director. Ask about me.
What's your favorite location to shoot at?
My house.
In your house?
Yeah.
Like film set?
Yeah.
Magic happens there.
Magic happens there. Yeah. Nobody's going to be saying,
you need to wrap up.
We need to wrap up. We need to leave. You told us you are going to leave at 8:00. It is now 8:30. Yeah. Or it is now 10 p.m. So, yeah.
Okay.
And what's the next mountain you want to climb?
I want to establish myself as a filmmaker. Mm-hmm. I feel like right now people still see me as the girl who wrote the book, and the book happened to be turned into a TV series. Mm-hmm. But I'm really excited to produce the slate of films and shows that I've been developing, and like really establish myself, you know, as a filmmaker. I feel like this is my next chapter.
Is it on your Instagram bio?
Author, filmmaker.
It says author, producer.
But yeah. Filmmaker.
Does it actually say filmmaker or producer? I'm not sure. I think it says producer.
But filmmaker.
I should probably filmmaker.
Speak manifest.
It. Yes. You did it. So yeah. Put it out there.
Mm-hmm.
So the last question I have for you is, we always ask every guest, who do you want to see on the Afropolitan podcast? Whose story do you want to see out there?
Whose story have I heard recently that I have been? Ryan Alabi.
Why?
So his Instagram handle is Ryan Oni Photo.
I know him. Yeah.
He literally, Isoke, my sister, found him when he was, I think he was just out of university.
in Kwara State in Ilorin, and she brought him on to do BTS, like promo shots for Smart Money Woman, and we developed a relationship with him like since then. And to see that boy's work ethic, his creativity, like what he's been able to like build in the last 5 years is so inspiring to me. He's doing his exhibition today, actually. He's doing his exhibition today at the Art Hotel, his first exhibition. He's basically taken some street people. So the Agbero on his streets, like the king of boys on his streets, he took them, styled them, transformed them, and did this documentary and portrait story type thing. Basically like showing their transformation and doing like a body of work that speaks to like self-esteem, regardless of like your circumstances and all of that. And just seeing his work like grow this much has really, really inspired me. So yeah, you should definitely interview him. I think he has such an incredible story to tell.
Ryan will definitely be reaching out.
Well, thank you so much, Vanessa. I love hearing your story. A lot of the things you shared today, I know it's going to be super valuable to our community.
Thank you so much.
Thank you,
Vanessa, for having me. Yay!